In 1807, William Wordsworth drafted a poem titled Character of the Happy Warrior. Who is the happy warrior? My vote is the Apostle Paul, who said while on trial, I cheerfully make my defense. I'm not sure I could rise rhetorically or emotionally as well as Paul did, given the litany of false accusations against him. However, the inward light of the gospel of Jesus Christ shined brightly in the apostle, no matter the adverse circumstances he faced. Happy warriors make us believe in our most noble ideals. Virtuous and brave, they remain unflinching and cheerful, even in the face of adversity. Though attacked often, Paul never lost his joy in the Lord or sacrificed virtue. He remained gritty and graceful. A happy warrior indeed. I'm Ron Jones, and this is Something Good.
If you were on trial for being a Christian, what would you say? How would you defend yourself? Hello and welcome to Something Good with Dr. Ron Jones. I'm Brian Davis. Thanks for stopping by. In Acts chapter 22, the Apostle Paul appears before the Jewish Supreme Court, also known as the Sanhedrin. But rather than defend himself, he defends the gospel of Jesus Christ. And he does it, surprisingly enough, with a cheerful attitude. Stay with us now as Ron moves ahead in his series, Paul, Surprised by Grace. Or visit somethinggoodradio.org to listen to the broadcast on demand on your schedule. That's somethinggoodradio.org. From Atlantic Shores Baptist Church in Virginia Beach, Virginia, where he serves as lead pastor, here's Ron with today's Something Good Radio message, a cheerful defense of the gospel.
Lord Nelson was an important military leader in British history. After his death, a poet, actually a man who served as England's poet laureate for many, many years, a guy named William Wordsworth, drafted a poem that many say was about Lord Nelson. It was titled Character of the Happy Warrior. If none of that makes any sense to you or you have any reference to it, it might be because the poem was published in 1807. But since then, phrases from this poem, which are 85 lines in length, I mean, it's a commitment to read through this poem. Phrases from it have appeared in important speeches, and some of those speeches made in America's presidential politics. So, for example, Franklin Roosevelt referred to Alfred Smith as the happy warrior when he nominated him for President of the United States during the 1924 Democratic National Convention. I have yet to find a time that Ronald Reagan referred to himself as a happy warrior. That would be a little odd for somebody to do that. But many other people recognized him as a happy warrior. Even Reagan's political opponents noted his optimism, his charm, his likability. He could always take a tense situation and with a little bit of humor, you know, turn it toward his good. The same was true with Herbert Humphrey, who served as Lyndon Johnson's vice president. He was also a senator from Minnesota, and Humphrey was known for his sunny personality while simultaneously committing himself to civil liberties. Happy warriors like these men and others make us believe in our most noble ideals. They are virtuous and brave. They remain unflinching and cheerful in the face of great adversity. Who is the happy warrior, Wordsworth asks? Who is he that every man in arms should wish to be? He goes on to say, it is the generous spirit who, when brought among the tasks of real life, hath wrought upon the plan that pleased his boyish thought, whose high endeavors are an inward light that makes the path before him always bright. Great words from Wordsworth. And he goes on to say that the happy warrior also cares more about what God thinks of him than what man thinks of him. He concludes by saying, and while the mortal mist is gathering, he draws his breath in confidence of heaven's applause. We need more poets like Wordsworth. Where are they today? And we need more happy warriors like the one he describes so eloquently in his poem. Now, we're in a study of Paul's missionary journeys, and as you might guess, I kind of think the Apostle Paul was a happy warrior long before Wordsworth ever penned his poem. We're in Acts chapter 24, and after arriving in Caesarea with a military escort of some 200 plus soldiers, the Apostle Paul, who is now a prisoner in chains, makes a cheerful defense, he says, before Felix, who is the governor in charge and based in Caesarea. And Paul makes this defense as he's on trial, following the gloomy indictments that are brought against him from really his Jewish colleagues, Pharisees and Sadducees, whom he stood before, you know, the Sanhedrin in Jerusalem in the chapter before. With all of that in mind, let's begin in chapter 24 in verse 1, where it says, after 5 days, the high priest Ananias came down with some elders and a spokesman, one Tertullus, and they laid before the governor their case against Paul. And when he had been summoned, Tertullus began to accuse him, saying, since through you we enjoy much peace, and since by your foresight, most excellent Felix, reforms are being made for this nation, in every way and everywhere we accept this with all gratitude. But to detain you no further, I beg you in your kindness to hear us briefly. Yawn, 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 right? Verse 5, for we have found this man, referring to Paul, we have found this man a plague, one who stirs up riots among all the Jews throughout the world and is a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. He even tried to profane the temple, but we seized him. By examining him yourself, you will be able to find out from him about everything of which we accuse him. The Jews also joined in the charge, Luke says, affirming that all these things were so. So 5 days after Paul arrives in Caesarea, Ananias, the high priest, shows up from Jerusalem with his legal team, led by an orator named Tertullus, who we might see as the lead attorney. And after the customary flattery that lawyers would give to, you know, governors and judicial people like Felix, Tertullus presents his charges against Paul, and they are threefold. First of all, the Jewish lawyer makes a personal charge by saying Paul was a plague. Ah, this guy is like a bad plague. Another translation says he's a troublemaker, a public menace, a pestilent fellow. Now all of this was subjective, and it was driven by personal opinion. But this is what they thought of the Apostle Paul, and it wasn't very flattering. The second charge was political, and Tertullus accused Paul of insurrection. He stirs up riots, he says, and also charged him with leading an illegal religion, called it the sect of the Nazarenes. Now, it was true in Roman law that you couldn't just start a religion. It had to be approved by the Romans. And Judaism was approved by the Romans. It was legal. But they wanted to distance Paul from Judaism and from the faith of the fathers and called this a sect of the Nazarenes, because they wanted to get him on this charge, albeit trumped up as it was. The third charge was theological by suggesting Paul had profaned the temple. Now, this harkens to that time in Acts 22 and 23, to where they happened to see Paul walking around Jerusalem, maybe in the vicinity of the temple, with a Gentile friend of his who was now a follower of Jesus. And earlier in Acts, Luke says, they supposed that Paul brought him into the temple. Now, back then, the temple had a place called the Court of the Gentiles. They also had a place called the Court of Women. And women could only go so far, and Gentiles could only go so far. You crossed those boundaries. Oh, and they said you profaned the temple. The third charge was that Paul had done that. And here's Paul, the defendant, the prisoner in chains, calmly listening to all the charges before Felix turns to him, gives him a head nod, and lets him respond. to the charges that were laid out before him. Keep in mind, at this time, you defended yourself. You didn't have a team of lawyers sitting with you. And we pick it up in verse 10, and it says, "And when the governor had nodded to him to speak, Paul replied, 'Knowing that for many years you have been a judge over this nation, I cheerfully make my defense. You can verify that it is not more than 12 days since I went up to worship in Jerusalem, and they did not find me disputing with anyone or stirring up a crowd, either in the temple or in the synagogues or in the city. Neither can they prove to you what they now bring up against me. But this I confess to you, that according to the way," and that's how they referred to Jesus' followers, they were following the way, "according to the way which they call a sect, I worship the God of our fathers, believing everything laid down by the law and written in the prophets, having a hope in God, which these men themselves accept, that there will be a resurrection of both the just and the unjust." Now, I was drawn to that phrase where Paul says, "I cheerfully make my defense," because I don't know that I could do that. I don't know that I could rise to the level of rhetoric or to the emotional level of the Apostle Paul to keep a smile on my face and not bite back, especially in light of the litany of false accusations they were making against him. I think that would be hard for any of us. But the inward light of the gospel of Jesus Christ shined brightly in Paul, no matter the adverse circumstances he faced. His battles were real. Every one of them were worth fighting, because he wasn't fighting for his own life. He was fighting for the advancement of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And Paul had long since said, "I consider my life of nothing, of no consideration. If only I could finish the course and fulfill the ministry that God had given to me." And this is why Paul could make a cheerful defense. He never lost his joy in the Lord or sacrificed his virtue. And even though Paul faced enough troubles to make sullen most people's spirits, he was always gritty and graceful at the same time. He was, in every sense of the word and of the poem, a happy warrior.
Up next, the second half of today's Something Good radio message with Dr. Ron Jones. Today's teaching is part of Ron's series, Paul, Surprised by Grace. Stop by somethinggoodradio.org to listen or watch the entire series or to download Ron's sermon notes from today's message. That's somethinggoodradio.org. While you're there, use the Explore feature at the top of the homepage to share your prayer requests with us. Our ministry team is always ready to lift you up in prayer. Well, Paul may have been on trial for his life, but he didn't try to save his life. His mission was to advance the gospel of Jesus Christ. With the rest of today's Something Good radio message, a cheerful defense of the gospel. Once again, here's Dr. Ron Jones.
A happy warrior. And he began his defense by avoiding the customary flattery. Again, I kind of want to go, ugh, when I hear, you know, Tertullus laying on all the flattery as they did, you know, to people like Felix in the day. Perhaps Paul remembered Psalm 12 and verse 13, which says, "May the Lord cut off all the flattering lips, the tongue that makes great boasts." I mean, Felix wasn't deserving of any of that flattery. The great reforms that the lead attorney referred to, that's a stretch. That's really questionable. And besides, given how Felix had treated the Jews with cruelty, the governor was not worthy of even the slightest of insincere praise. And that's what flattery is. It's just insincere praise to try to ingratiate yourself to the person who is listening. Paul avoided all of that. He knew who Felix was. He didn't insult him, but he wasn't going to offer insincere praise. But rather, he very succinctly rejects the accusation that he stirred up riots in Jerusalem, because he knew it wasn't true. He even alludes to the timeline there. He says, I was in here just, you know, for these days. And later he talks about how he spent most of his time working with a group of Jews who were involved in a Nazarite vow. And he participated in that rite of purification, and he spent time with them. And he didn't have time to stir up riots. Likewise, the Way, which again described Jesus' followers, was not a new religion. Paul made clear of that. That would have prohibited him from being a part of it. If it was, that would have been a point, you know, for the prosecution there, if they could prove that it was a newer religion. But Paul presented his faith as the fulfillment of, listen to this, everything laid down by the law and written in the prophets. In other words, I'm just continuing on what these men who are accusing me believe themselves. But he saw Jesus as the Messiah, as the fulfillment of all the promises and prophecies in the Old Testament. Paul made the case that he served the God of the Hebrews, not some new God, that he placed his hope in him, and that he believed everything in the Hebrew scriptures, including the anticipation of a resurrection and the final judgment before his God. It's really a masterful defense when you read it, and it's carefully crafted and succinct. And Paul even goes on to say in verse 16, and he probably provoked a few sneers from the prosecution side, but he says, "So I always take pains to have a clear conscience toward both God and man." This is the second time in two chapters that Paul mentions the word conscience. We talked about that last week. He wasn't saying he was perfect, but he says, I have a good conscience, because when my conscience tells me no or yes, I always listen to what God is saying to me. And then he cruised right ahead to show how disingenuous it was to say that he profaned the temple. Again, he entered the temple to pay large sums of money in support of the four Nazarites with whom he had participated in this purification rites. That's where he had spent his time, not stirring up riots over here. And besides, he had brought another offering. Remember, for the poor in Jerusalem, he collected that offering from all the churches that he had planted in Macedonia and Achaia, from the Galatian region there. And he was bringing this from Gentile believers for the Jewish poor in Jerusalem. Who does this if his intention is to defile the temple, is his point. And Paul, again, masterfully refutes the accusations against him. He closes his defense with a frank statement about the resurrection of the dead. And this is where he was going the whole time. Because again, Paul's not so much defending himself to protect his own life. He's looking for a gateway into the gospel. And he says in verse 21, "It is with respect to the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial before you today." He reframes the whole case. And this explains why those that showed up among the Pharisees and the Sadducees were at each other. Because remember, the Sadducees didn't believe in the afterlife. The Pharisees did. Paul dropped that into that conversation back in Jerusalem, and it stirred up the Sanhedrin. And now they're stirred up among themselves. It also explains why they don't like Paul. And it opened up the possibility for a future conversation with Felix and others about the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ. And that was Paul's aim the whole time. Now, Felix responds to all of this as you might think a politician would. He hears both sides and then he says, "Oh, I'll decide on another day." He delays. He pushes it down the road. He kicks the can down the road. And verse 22 tells us, "But Felix, having a rather accurate knowledge of the way, put them off, saying," when Lysias, that's Claudius Lysias, the tribune, comes down, in other words, when my boss gets here, "I will decide your case." That was a convenient putting off for a later day. "And then he gave orders to the centurion that he should be kept in custody but have some liberty, and that none of his friends should be prevented from attending to his needs." We know that Paul was in Caesarea in prison for up to 2 years. He had some liberties, and people could come and meet with him and attend to his needs. But it's interesting that Luke here says that Felix had a rather accurate knowledge of the way. And that might have come because his wife, Drusilla, was Jewish. She was the daughter of Herod Agrippa I. And with them living in Caesarea, they would have had some contact with some of the early Christians who made their way there. Also, because of Felix's responsibility as the procurator, the governor, he would have interacted with followers of Jesus as well. But Paul's testimony added to Felix's knowledge of the way. But Felix hears all of this and he decides to delay Paul's case until Claudius comes. Let's pick it up again in verse 24. It says, after some days, and we don't know how long some days were, but somewhere in that time frame of 2 years, Felix came with his wife Drusilla, who was Jewish, and sent for Paul and heard him speak about faith in Christ Jesus. And as he reasoned about righteousness and self-control and the coming judgment, Felix was alarmed and said, I will put my faith and trust in Jesus Christ right now, Paul. No, he didn't say that. He didn't say that. Here's what he said. Go away for the present time. When I get an opportunity, I will summon you. He is a delay master, isn't he? Verse 26, at the same time, he hoped that money would be given him by Paul. That was kind of customary. Bribery was very much a part of that time. And so he sent for him often and conversed with him. When 2 years had elapsed, listen to this, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus. And desiring to do the Jews a favor, Felix left Paul in prison.
When you share your faith, you don't have to choose between making a compelling argument or telling the truth. The most compelling argument is the truth. You've been listening to Something Good with Dr. Ron Jones. I'm so glad you joined us. We'll pick it up right here next time in part two of Ron's message, A Cheerful Defense of the Gospel.
The song Route 66 by Bobby Troup captured the heartbeat of a generation that dreamed of traveling the open road on US 66 from Chicago, Illinois to Santa Monica, California.
Get your kicks on Route 66.
Get your kicks on Route 66 became the rally cry and part of the song's popular lyric. If reading the 66 books of the Bible was like a Route 66 road trip across America, people might do more than casually flip through the best-selling book of all time. That idea captured my heart and inspired me to write a book called The Ultimate Road Trip Through the Bible, making the Bible's story accessible to a new generation of people. Get your kicks on the biblical Route 66. Join me on the ultimate road trip through the Bible.
Ron's new book, The Ultimate Road Trip Through the Bible, is now available as a 2-volume set covering the 66 books of the Old and New Testaments. For a gift of $50 or more, request your copy of the set. When you order the print books, you will also get unlimited access to the Route 66 Digital Library, a $275 value. The Digital Library contains 66 video sermons, 66 audio messages, 66 downloadable sermon notes, and 8 ebooks. To order your copy of The Ultimate Road Trip Through the Bible, Volumes 1 and 2, through the Old and New Testaments, go to somethinggoodradio.org. That's somethinggoodradio.org. The Ultimate Road Trip Through the Bible makes a great addition to any home library. Request both volumes today at somethinggoodradio.org. Now here's Ron with a preview of tomorrow's message.
I want to know Him. I want to know Christ. And the word know there is not to just know about Him, but to know Him personally, to know Him experientially. You know, sometimes the best way to get to know somebody is to walk in their sandals. I want to know Him in the power of His resurrection and in a way that I may share His sufferings, becoming like Him in His death. Wow. Who wants to sign up for that? A happy warrior.
That's next time when Dr. Ron Jones shares part two of his message, A Cheerful Defense of the Gospel. Join us then for Something Good. For Ron and the entire team here at Something Good Radio, I'm Brian Davis, saying God bless and thanks for listening.